Exactly. So, Marco, we were just discussing. I mentioned, was it yesterday, that we were working on these grants, and both Mary and Jocelyn are involved in the grants. So, we were discussing, one of the grants is being written in French, and the other one in English, and some of the terminology needs to be translated into French, and it's not. You know, so we have this idea, this term that was invented by some other people called vast narrative, but doesn't translate easily into French. So I've been
vast
talking
narrative.
Is that vast what? Narrative, yeah. So it's kind of a description of shared multi-universe worlds where lots of writers and different film and different media formats are involved in the. So it's both a shared world and a world that gets expressed through many different media. But finding the right term in French is a bit tricky. So,
well, that sounds very cool. That sounds very. It's like planets within a cosmos. Is kind of how I imagine
it. It is, yes. You know?
I think, and then you could have, you know, galaxies, you could have star clusters, you could have nebulae where worlds are forming. So I think it allows for a lot of possibilities within.
Yeah. So
that's very cool. Good luck with that.
Yeah, it's coming along. It's coming along. I had a very intense, I mentioned yesterday, a writing period on the weekend. I managed to produce two of these grants. One in English and one in French, and sent them out this week. So that's everybody's.
That was amazing, Jorge. You should say that. Amazing work. Yeah. Tremendous work. Yeah.
So may I ask if we could just stay on this for just a moment? Is there a grand unifying framework? What is the kind of container, if you will?
Yeah. So it's the follow up on the work that we did for the opera. Which, remember, is based on one of my science fiction stories from the Chronicles. And we're asking to do a second opera. The one that we did was focused on accepting difference. So another that is a bit difficult to understand or relate to, and then accepting the other. So it included gender other as well. So you know that from the plenum and
I saw the YouTube video of the opera.
So this is not plenum, but it's a different story from the same the opera was a different story from the same sequence, but not plenum. It was a different one. But we want to do a second one which is more focused toward disability. And so not one of the 15, but one of the four extra novels I wrote deals with disability. And so we're sort of beginning to frame how that might look. So one part is to develop a new upper. The second part of the work is to engage with different audiences, because even the opera that we have, what's interesting about it is to take it out and show it to different groups of people and elicit discussion about issues of gender, otherness, difference, tolerance, and these kinds of things. And the new opera that we would develop would allow us to address more sophisticated way things around disability. And then the third part of the proposal is to, Jocelyn and I have been working on this development of this online interactive co-creation environment, which is going live in a few weeks. So we're proposing to extend the tools that we already have and get some funding to do that. So
that sounds great.
It's a mix of different things.
Online co-creation environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful. So. Okay. I'd love to see it when it's live.
Including a fan fiction component, which Mary will be responsible for. So the idea of getting other people involved in writing, you know, parallel or different stories that take place in the same environment. So
that's very cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Miranda.
Let's come back to that.
Yeah.
Hi, sorry, I'm a bit late.
No, it's fine. I think we're all a bit, we were talking about this other project that because I'm in the process of putting some grant applications in. And so three of us and on the screen here are involved in the grant application. So.
Oh, well, good luck.
So shall we get started on the, I think I turned on the recording, did I? Yes, I did. Octavia Butler. It ended up on an uplifting note.
It did.
Sort of.
Well, I had expected Olamina to die a violent death, and she didn't. So that is some consolation, I guess, for everything that she and the others went through. It's terrible for me to learn that Marcos, the her brother, had betrayed her this, you know, her whole life by not revealing the existence of her daughter. That was pretty cruel, I think. And so, and I just finished it last night. I don't feel like I fully processed it, but the uplifting note with a bit of a lilt, I think, included.
I finished it at 3 in the morning, so I'm like you, Marco. I haven't fully processed it.
What about everybody else? How did you get along in the book?
It was quite painful. The themes of family estrangement and that it could never be mended, she doesn't reconcile with her daughter or her brother ever, and it was obviously realistic. I mean, it was just echoing so many things. Lots of things in this book are things that haven't happened to us personally, but I think that most of us have experiences of family estrangement to various degrees, and so it was just this extra kick of ow.
Yeah, because families don't reconcile easily, right? Often. So I know I had issues with my mother, and she died before we ever got to work them out. So I carry that unfinished business with me. You know?
It's interesting, the transformation of Earthseed from the destruction of Acorn into an actual movement, an actual fictional movement, although there are some fans who've kind of taken Earthseed as a religion. Doug shared a link to somebody's website where he lists all of the verses from Earthseed and has developed some like ritual practices based on the book, like gatherings, things like that. But if I had to like compare it to anything, it sounds a little bit like Scientology, like the way that it spread through, basically through an upper middle class and then into wealthy, you know, strata of society. Like she, you know, Acorn was an assemblage of the outcast, of, you know, the most dispossessed, the most marginalized, and she managed to create this initial community out of it, which was Acorn, but Acorn couldn't stand a chance in the environment of this, fundamentalist, fascist kind of, you know, regime of Andrew Jarrett. And so then the Crusaders came, they just, you know, destroyed Acorn, enslaved the people. I have to say, this slave collar is a horrifying device to imagine. I have had bad dreams about having like this, you know, collar around my neck, and it's like could just zap you, you know, make you really put you under its control. And it's like it was like technological dystopia, I think, at its most horrifying and most poignant, because I could imagine that working. I could really imagine that happening. But in any event, I think, you know, the destruction of Acorn, what was interesting is that it created the conditions for the flourishing of Earthseed once it was able to kind of leap, you know, from the strata of of the dispossessed into the strata of the people with wealth, and then they turned it into this worldwide, you know, cult that's actually doing space travel, like fulfilling the destiny. I don't know, in real life, it seems like the verses by themselves, they don't have enough gravitas, I think. So maybe it really has to do with, you know, all of the cult around Olamina and her, you know, her story and her magnetism that that leads to Earthseed's success ultimately. And then that sets up, I think, the tragedy of the story, which is that, you know, that comes at the cost of that family unity, because neither her brother nor her daughter can accept that she's, you know, become what they see as a cult leader, and as in some ways that they see her through the lens of Jarrett's Christian America still. So yeah, this is a novel that's going to stick with me for a while, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you can really see, I think, like we talked about last time, she intended for there to be more books and she stopped because this was too emotionally draining for her to write these, which I can completely understand. But you can see the space where those books would have been in that huge time jump at the end. And it does make me wonder, you know, one of the great things about this series so far is that it shows a lot of false starts and failures. You know, you try one thing, it doesn't work, you try another thing. And I do, like, the way you describe it kind of crystallized some discomfort I had with the final form that it took. And I suspect that future books would have been able to show you know, problems with that approach and new solutions and so on. It would have kept going. It would have, things would have cropped up that would have had to be addressed. And, but the need to finish it up in a single book, meant that we couldn't get into all of that, but I'm sure, I think it would have been there. I can see why she stopped, but, you can imagine the books that might have been.
I read in read or heard in an interview that she saw these, you know, Earthseed settlers going off and finding themselves onto other worlds, and there would be some worlds that would be living worlds, there would be other worlds that would have to be like terraformed or, you know, made habitable, but that they wouldn't encounter aliens, they wouldn't have to deal with that, they would just have to deal with the, you know, the hardships and the struggles of making a new life on a new world. And that it wouldn't be, you know, fantastical or easy in any way. That's at least what she said that she had in mind. She also said that in this interview that, or a different one, that it was too depressing. And that that's one of the reasons that, but I think she was working on them because there was a book called Parable of the Trickster that was, that there were notes for. And there's like an archive of her work, I think in Chicago. I have to look that up, there, you know, there are notes about the potential future novels, and I think it's, I mean, this, yeah, I could totally see why you would, I mean, this is just like the worst case scenario, like, of what the future could be like, so I don't know why I'd want to keep making it even, you know, trying to see if you can make it worse or, you know, how that plays out.
What I thought, one of the reasons why the ending of the book is quite uplifting is because society has changed. So society has started to reject the Jarrett mythos and has moved towards a kind of greater acceptance of uncertainty, right? Which is obviously built into the Earthseed mantra, the kind of the way it's organized. So because society changed, it became more acceptable to embrace a theology that was less certain, less built around certainty. So, I mean, she still talks about the present of people who need reassurance. And I guess she sort of hints at the idea that with the new woman, Balin, that they introduce simplicities into the, they simplify the message to some extent in order to make it more palatable to a broader group of people. So you also have this sense that they may have watered down a bit the Earthseed idea in order to make it reach a larger group. But no, it is still fairly encouraging as an ending of this, of the diptych. So
it's interesting that things got better, not necessarily because of her either. Like, you didn't have a sense that she brought down Jared. It was more like there was a cycle in society that had run its course, you know? Which might be encouraging for us to think about now when you see sort of patterns of more conservative leaders and more liberal leaders following one after the other. Maybe that's not encouraging, that it's just something we go through, that we cycle through as a society.
Well, they're almost like the war criminals, you know? Like their crimes have, you know, are being exposed. People have come out and are telling their stories. And although they still have this base of supporters and deniers, you know, who don't want to look at the reality, it seems like enough of the story, the true story, has come out that, you know, that movement no longer has the following, you know, or the promise or potential. It's becoming marginalized itself. So I think that is definitely, that is promising. It's good to see that, you know, that Butler was imagining that on a social scale, you know, as like the aftermath of this kind of pox that they called the pox. I feel like we're living in a pox right now, actually. It's some sort of, you know, outbreak. Not yet the full-fledged, you know, thing, but.
The Trump pox.
I just would like to add also that, the story itself is very, I would not compare it to the one we read previously because it was really awful, the story of losing children. But to get this kind of situation with your family is also something that is really, you can relate really to this kind of story. And that's all the feeling that you could have when that happened is really well represented. Even in the supra way of writing, you feel the anxiety of it. And it's amazing how she succeeds to let that pass. For the part of what you say about criminal war, I would say, like, what I like with her, with the way she presents the things, is she always gave us a doubt that the collectiveness that make a judgment on something or someone, collectiveness could be the family, could be the society, or could be a collectiveness, like a collective conscious, is really not to take it for granted. As what she said about the religion, like everyone is agreed to see truth, but the truth is maybe somewhere else. And I like really much this way of thinking because it gives to the individual a voice to think on their own. And what is strong here is that in the process of writing and the way she writes it, she gives that not only in the thematic but also in the way she wrote the text. Like how could I say that? We don't have that in French, so I don't have terminology for that, but she is really trying to induce it, to induce it, but not in an indirect way. When we wrote in French, we have that in an indirect way. Here she is more straightforward, but at the same time, she inducing a lot. It's just like in the writing, and I feel it I feel that this pattern she has of writing things is really to propagate the idea that individual people have their own truths, and it's what matter, even if they are wrong about the society. So when she talks about the dispute in the family, every side has their own reality somehow. I don't know how to explain that. And I feel like this is really the problem somehow, that nobody can challenge and say, well, you're right, you're wrong, you know, and if it is not obvious in the society, because you have so many people who think white or black, but in the family you cannot go this way because one thinks red, the other thinks blue, and the other one thinks green, and there is no match for all of this in the generalization of the process. And it's so beautifully put in words, this aspect. Sorry for my English, I have issues with my grammar sometimes.
I also noticed that as a sort of an interesting thing, but the turn for the better starts when she starts, when she draws people and she shares her drawings with the little verses added to it. I thought it was interesting because all of everything up till then has been about communication via words, and now she switches to communication through drawing. So I thought it was a very interesting focus on maybe the less. So it's a bit related to what you're saying, Jocelyn, in a way, because the family issues are all also things that aren't easily articulable in words, right? I mean, the brother who doesn't want to acknowledge certain things about the movement that he belongs to, and so he, instead of addressing them, he simply turns his back to them and to his sister as a result. That's very family typical in a way, you know, and it's but it's in the non-articulable part of communication, and the drawings are also non-articulable in a written spoken sense. So I'm not sure if there's a comment there about that, but I think it's kind of an interesting position to take.
I don't have a comment directly to you, Jeffrey, but going back to the family dynamics, I really think Butler did genius work with Larkin. Like she's essentially, Larkin is going through with just a simple commentary of, oh, well, this is my mother's journal. Didn't really like her. Actually, I kind of despise her. We're not really given a direct reason why throughout, I guess, the first three-fourths of the book, other than she has this cult and I don't really like it. And I was not a part of that. She wasn't a part of my life. So it makes sense that she hates her, but there's so much thrown in at the end that really brings it all together in such a genius way, I think, of it, how Larkin herself had abuse, had definite father issues with her non-biological father. So she sides with, there's all sorts of psychological issues going there, how she relates to males. And then in a way, her story parallels Lauren's, where she doesn't agree with the extreme version of the Christian, I can't remember the term they use, but she's essentially alone in her family, her adopted family, where she doesn't fully agree with these Christian values. She takes on a different persona, that the Asha Vere, or Asha Vere, who is in a way kind of the doppelganger of Lauren, as this powerful sower of seeds, I guess Ashavaya is more in the Christian society, destroying any heathen whatevers. But deep in her mind, she has this these stories, scenarios she creates through the dream mask, in which she's creating her own visions. But it doesn't turn out to be cult-like. She kind of turns away from that, and it just turns out to be stories. So she doesn't have that utopian vision, or maybe it's an updated utopian vision, similar to her Olamina, to where she's coming up with scenarios, but they can be erased in a certain sense. It doesn't have to be the official utopian quality. But yeah, I just really liked how it all came together with Larkin kind of still, even after their talk at the end, when Lauren finally meets her daughter, Larkin, and finds out that she essentially has been kept from her, the truth has been kept from her, and she still sides with, well, I don't really like my mother. Right? At that point, she could have made a turn to join, not necessarily join Earthseed, but see her mother as a strong figure. But I guess in the perception, like Marco was getting at, it's kind of the cult leader, the Scientologist, like, oh, I don't know if I want to touch that type of thing. But so just the family dynamics are really strong with how it develops there. I like it.
That's cool. I didn't like when once you said it, I was like, yes, they actually are very parallel in so many ways. Like Lauren had to define herself against her father, and Asha is defining herself against her mother. And yet Asha's trajectory doesn't seem to is so much more confined than what Lauren was able to do. They follow similar paths, but Asha's has just been so, or Larkin's has been so, I don't know, warped in a lot of ways.
I think the fact that she has become a dream mask, I mean, that's cool, but also it's sad in that way, because it's like she creates virtual worlds, she creates virtual realities, virtual heroics, whereas Olamina is doing it, you know, for real, like, you know, in physically with real people, going to real other planets. And just looking at it in that way, I think that, you know, there's a strength and there's a perseverance, a transcendent quality to Lauren's vision and her determination, like her willpower to, you know, stick through everything she's been through to bring this vision to fruition, that I mean, it's really, really heroic. Somehow the idea that of doing that in virtual space is not as heroic.
And Balin comments about her mother, right? So Butler introduces this whole backstory about Balin's mother, who was lost inside the virtual worlds. And so there's a kind of a comment there about the lesser role of virtual worlds compared to the physical world. So I think that reinforces what you're saying, Marco.
Yeah, I think I was really affected too by the massive betrayal that we find out about at the end of the book. And I just couldn't really, the fact that I really wanted to know more from Larkin's perspective and from Marco's perspective about why they talk a little bit about that they saw each other a few times, but I just find it, just wanted to know more. And also I wanted to know more about Larkin's life and what are the particular scenarios that she created and what her research was about and how she kind of related, how did she manage to like avoid or kind of relate to everything that Olamina was doing between the time they met and the time that she died, because they were still in touch, because she said that she was invited to the I don't know what the right word is, but yeah, I found it quite devastating. But I, and I guess
center, the workshop center they had there, is that what you're referring to?
And when they had, when the first people set off, she, I think she was invited to that, but she didn't go
to the launch. Yeah.
So I just thought it was, it's really sad.
And I guess still continue with this idea of Lauren being the hero, the one with the physical, tangible story, and Larkin's scenarios as not necessarily as valiant. It almost ties in what Jocelyn, Mary, and Jeffrey were talking about. And I think, Mary, you mentioned the sandbox. I don't know how that's thought of, but I'm imagining, like, you can make these creations, but at the same time, you can completely clean the slate. There might be a little bit of disappointment that your great structure has been destroyed, but then at the same time, all the materials still lay there where you can, well, create a new scenario that will actually work. So I'm imagining that this virtual reality dream mask is a safe place to develop such a thing on Earth. Clearly, things are getting better now that Jared is potentially out of office. I guess it's 40, 50, 60 years in the future once we reach the very end. Maybe, I can't remember, but it sounds like things are a little bit better in society where there is a chance to maybe develop a decent society. You don't have to go to the stars. So maybe in future books, it would have paralleled like the actual physical visitations to Mars and other planets or stars and this dream world where it can be torn down and rebuilt. So I like that quality. Maybe it wasn't touched upon as much, but that's just something that appeals to me.
Another thing I noticed while I was looking at this this pair of books is that the titles are interesting because the stories, in a way, they're kind of tangential to the titles, right? The parable, the titles are both about two different parables, and the parables, although they're illustrative of some things that are going on in the story, in a way, the stories don't have a lot directly towards the parables. It's kind of, it's more where, like the acorn at the end of the community acorn at the end of the parable of the sower is the sowed seed. So the parable, so it's the result of the book is the leads us into the parable of the sower. And the same with the parable of the talents. It's the result of the book that leads us into this idea that is portrayed in the parable, not the story itself, but the place it arrives at that seems to be correspond to the title. So so I just found it interesting that it was kind of tangential as a set of titles. And something interesting about Butler's sense of indirection in her writing, which we also find in the text itself. She, although there are lots of blatant, obvious things that she portrays, in a lot of ways, the story is told through indirection rather than in a direct portrait.
I guess I think of the parable of the talents as a story about the obligation to use our gifts, right? And it's a story in which, like the biblical story, not the book, the biblical parable is about, is I think telling us that if we have an ability to, a talent, a call, we have to do it. And if we don't, we're punished for that. That was the outcome of it. So I suppose in this book, Lauren is someone who uses her talents and eventually it does return to her tenfold. And maybe Marcus is the one who has a talent but refuses to use it. And and isn't isn't necessarily punished by the narrative the way it is in the Bible, but there's something there that sort of, that not doing the good thing that you can do is as bad as doing a bad thing.
But he, Marcus, he does pursue his dream. That's, in a way, he mirrors, I think, Olamina, because he's ambitious. He wants to be the leader of a movement. He wants to be somebody who teaches, somebody who changes the world in a big, significant way. I think that he takes the darker path precisely because he ties his own destiny to that of Christian America. And he doesn't actually develop an original idea. And by original, I don't just mean different. I mean actually like reflective of truth, like reflective of something prior to or transcendental with respect to the human. By that I mean that parable of the talents, you could look at it as a moralistic kind of tale. Like you can use it as a defense of capitalism, for example, right? Like this is why investors should be rewarded, and people who don't participate in venture economy get what they deserve. But you could also just look at it as a reflection of natural truth or natural law, insofar as the way that nature works, right? And this is, I'm not saying that capitalism is equivalent to natural law or that natural law is not constructed even by capitalism, but I mean that you could just see it play out in events. And in that sense, like what Olamina says about her truth, like God is change, it's really not true because she says it. It's not true because the verses are, poetically written. It is actually plays out in her life. And she's like it's a demonstration. Like her life is a demonstration of that. Events are a demonstration of that. And I think also the parable also relates, the difference between the parable of the talents and the parable of the sower is that the talents relates to a change in her method. Like Jeffrey was saying, where it ends up. When you sow seeds, you just throw the seeds, right? You don't just throw them. You may have, a field with rows and so forth, but you're giving them to the ground to sprout up. With talents, that's something that's given to a person and it's given individually. So she goes from having a community to like where basically her impact, her influence would be limited to that community, to, as she writes in her journals, to teaching the teachers. So I'm going to find individuals and teach them, and then they're going to go out and become ambassadors and evangelists and like community organizers, so that this will spread by that kind of apostolic setup. And then one of her first investments basically is in Len, is in the character that what's her name? Jill sets her up with to go north to Portland. All good things in Portland, right? Like that's the Portlandia. This is but she becomes basically almost, I think her story is not told. I think it would be interesting for her. She'd be like the Paul or something, she'd be like the one who really goes out and has the way to market it, has the way to market the message, get it to the masses, simplify it, ritualize it. It seems like they figure that scaling issue, of going from the lone visionary to the multinational organization. So yeah, it's very interesting.
And they have that term shaper as a sign of respect towards a person. So I thought that was really interesting. And I sort of would like to know more about who gets called a shaper and what exactly they do. Because it was sort of slipped in almost into the stream somehow, and not a lot was said about it, but it was intriguing, I found.
Did that already exist at Acorn? I can't remember.
I think she was called, I think there were a couple that were called shapers. But it's one thing to have it in a small community and another thing to have it in a planetary movement, right? So
I felt in a way like the talents could have been just as easily the parable of the sower. Like she's learning where to take her seeds and not just scatter them in places that are going to be destroyed. Or even the parable of the phoenix. Like beginning, she has this community and then is destroyed completely. And then she destroys Acorn. At one point it quotes something about the phoenix will rise again. So it could have been, that could have been the title, but I don't know who said it, maybe Mary. It isn't really revealed until the end that the talents are out there. And yeah, in a way, Lauren, everybody has their own talents, and I don't think anybody's being punished for not using their talents in this book, at least the three or four kind of heroes or main characters. They each pursue their talents and do a good job of it with the crowns they were given in their box. But near the end, Lauren is sowing the seeds for others to utilize their talents, I suppose, like what Jeffrey's saying there.
Yeah, I would like to also to add something, like the fact that she used the words parable, I cannot say it well in English. It's very interesting. When I was young, I was forced to listen to religious story and take classes in religion that my family were not related to. And I thought that this parable was very like a moralization of something that is a little bit too narrow to be universal somehow, and the fact that they use a story out of it that was kind of old for us, that we're not really fitting what we were experiencing as children somehow, but we can relate it to, but not really in the real life. This form of way of telling something without really telling it, but you have to think about it and to find the moral out of it. It's at the same time very interesting, like it triggers your imagination, but at the same time, I remember that when I was young, I was feeling very annoyed by the way that the writer wants to lead us. And because I thought that if I wanted to do something else with a story, I was not allowed to, because it was a religious study and everyone should think the same. And just as this fact, the form was really annoying for me. Religious people always take parable to say something they were not supposed to say in the right way. It's just like making humor of something that you're not supposed to laugh at the very first, but then everyone agrees that it's laughable, so everyone will laugh. Like, let me just take an example. Like, for example, when you have the, and I'm not saying I'm a believer or not believer, but it's just about the process itself. Because if we enter in the subject, of course, we're going to get lost. But for example, people who talks about UFO, at first it was like, you know, like I saw something that was unidentified. I was not able to see what was really happening, but I have to notice it. That was unusual and I cannot put a word on it. Okay. So, of course, all kind of interpretation can come and be made, were made out of that. However, for any kind of reason, the media took this kind of tales and, just witnessed, report of some kind of witness and try to make fun of it. And you can see in the literature of this kind of events, you have all kind of parodies that were built up out of people who can see things in the sky and think they are really seeing like UFO and green little man and stuff like that. So, and it detaches us from the truth, not meaning that they were right or wrong, but meaning that if you look at the facts without having this collectiveness of thinking of facts for what it is or what it is not, that limitate our imagination to see something else. Maybe it's something else, but because we are forced to look at the same direction and forced by the group, forced by you know, I know the truth, that's not true, or I know the truth, this is true, and I will tell you what it is, and you have to accept it without seeing it with your own eyes. It's really painful. And I think that she is not trying to use a parable in the sense of a form that you can trigger information that is a collectiveness. She makes us look at the parable form on itself as something we should discuss, something we should put in question regarding groups that is a family, regarding groups that is the moral of the society. And she's not trying to force one direction on another, but she is using the same form that was used by religious people to trigger the truth, to trigger also that singularity is something that we should be aware when we trying to grab a group towards the truth. And it's made with a very, how could I say that? Her writing is really precious in that way, because she is not pulling one side on another. Of course, when she makes the character talk, she is pulling one thing on another. But I would say that the demonstration, the way she's trying to do it, she's trying to induce it, she's using the same form. So I think it's really a piece of art trying to finalize this way of thinking. And I get really amazed, because at first I was just by the name parable, I was just annoyed. But after that, I was really surprised at the way she used it. And I'm not saying that religious are wrong to don't use parable, but it's the more the way that they induce it at school that is making me feel a bit allergic of it. So it's just that.
So that was well said, and that makes me think of, maybe Marco said it, but just noticing that Butler has these multiple perspectives as she writes, and each character might be a representative of the conflicting views within her own mind or viewpoint. So, yeah, thanks for that.
I also wanted to come back to what you were saying, Mary, about the parable of the talents being about using one's talents, because I think that's there, but I also think that the parable, the way that it's recounted, is not just about using the talents, but it's about exchanging your talents for another talent, right? So there's this idea that you put out your talents and you get back something else. And that's clearly what Lauren is doing. She's putting stuff out and getting something back that's different than what she put out. Whereas Marco is not doing that as much. He's putting out and he's getting back the same kind of thing that he's putting out. So, I think that maybe I'm reading a bit too much into it, but it seems to me that what Lauren is doing is closer to this idea of exchanging a talent than some of the others.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on some of that because I thought one of the aspects that I really loved about this book is I get that exchange and how Lauren moves away from preaching towards more making work. So much description of practices and of labor, and I think of mutual aid. This exchange of talents, I thought that was really interesting. That's throughout the. And the different forms of technology that come in, like with the collars, I was thinking so much of tasers and taser technology, and with the Dreamcasts. I mean, I feel like there's been this explosion in VR in recent years, and it's interesting. I used to work with design students, and loads of them are doing so much in VR. So I think there's like a lot of experimentation. So it just made me, want to know more about the those technologies and the role that they played in her imagination. But yeah, the exchange of different skills and practices was really powerful for me.
Going back to Jocelyn's point about parables or beliefs being forced on one, I think that there's an interesting distinction between Christian America and how they operate and Earthseed. I mean, even though Lauren is an evangelical and she's like a proselytizer, like it's not like, I think religions can can be categorized almost by whether or not they endorse proselytization. Some actively believe that others have to be converted to the belief system and to the faith, and other. Like Buddhism doesn't necessarily believe that. It's more like, here's what we have, nirvana, enlightenment, take it if you want it. It's, you don't have to if you don't want to. And Lauren has a sense of purpose that I think is part of what distinguishes Earthseed. One, it's voluntary, but right. I mean, you have to if you don't want it, they're not going to force it on you. They're not going to put a slave collar on you and force you to, emigrate to another planet. Right. But two, why the other planet? Like why that extraterrestrial destiny? Why that goal? And I think it has to do with this sense of purpose that she has. And that she believes people need, like that's I think a thing. She believes that humanity needs to have a big transcendental purpose in order for their talents to best be expressed. I think that that's one of the arguments for Earthseed, and that one of the critiques of Christian America or of is that either the heaven is unrealistic in the sense that it's not physically possible, right? That like Earthseed is physically possible, or it's earthbound in the sense that it doesn't provide a way to escape or to transcend or to go beyond the present situation. So like the change is like an engine. It's like if you can harness change, if you could shape chaos, as she says in one point, if you can become a shaper, or through the collectivity, right? The Earthseed collective, they become a shaper of the chaotic energies of history. They can use that to achieve great things, but what having that sense of destiny or purpose provides, I almost think it's arbitrary. It doesn't have to be going to other planets. I mean, the point of it is, it has to be big and hard. Like that's what Lauren says. It has to be difficult to achieve. And that's what brings out the best in us. I think there's something to say about that. I know that Octavia Butler doesn't really draw on Nietzsche and that tradition. But I feel like that's part of like a Nietzschean sort of move, is it's not so much what's true, because this is a creative act. Like, it could be, instead of going to other planets, it could be, I don't know, let's do time travel or something. Let's like put all of our resources into figuring out like how to travel through time. I mean, it could be anything. The point is that the creative vision mobilizes people to work together, to think big, I think probably a shadow side to that, for sure. And Larkin is that, the shadow side. And I still think the argument that, well, why don't we fix what we have here on Earth first? I think that there's a perhaps a denial there, like there, it, you know, within the Earth seed belief system, like that. That like they're willing to skip town, like let the Earth rot, and find other places to live, rather than face the work of actually healing the planet. I think that would be a shadow side on the Earth seed perspective. Anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but trying to tie together various threads here.
That sounded quite true to me, that it, when you said it didn't necessarily have to be traveling to other stars, it just needed to be something, which makes it interesting to think about what would happen if she had written that next book about people on other planets. What would have been, what comes next when you don't have a huge teleological part of your faith? And I guess we've found that faiths survive having that taken away, like the millenarianism or whatever. People who think the end of the world is coming don't disappear when the world doesn't end. And so maybe Earthseed doesn't disappear when you get to the end point either.
But there's almost no end point, because it could go on and on. You just keep going, new stars, new solar systems, new planets. So maybe it becomes sort of repetitive at the end, and you need a different, more imminent teleology or something.
What I read in the biography about Butler, there was a discussion about what she was planning to do with the subsequent books, and the sort of thrust of what she was working towards was this idea that these groups of colonists arrive at other planets, and these planets have their own living Gaia-like entities, and they reject the arriving colonists as being viruses from outside or intruders. And so they have to struggle with the planet in order to get a kind of level of acceptance. So you can see it's the same, it's taking this idea of the outsider and the need to struggle with the environment in order. So in a way, the same sort of difficulties that they encounter in developing the group on Earth are repeated when they get to the other planets because of these. So it's an interesting concept, because it's focused on a kind of an idea about alienness that's different from what one finds a lot of in science fiction. And so it's a kind of a shame that she passed away before she could do this, because it would have been really interesting, I think. But and another thing about that, her heroine in this story dies suddenly and while doing other things, and she herself died in a similar kind of way. So that's a kind of an odd echo between the writer and the character as well. Obviously not intentionally, but...
Well, and I noticed that's happened a lot of time, that I'm thinking about many cases like Fauré, Mozart, they all die when they were written their own Requiem, some of them in the middle of it, some of them just after it. And you have many examples like this of people thinking about death, and their deaths are matching what they were planning or doing. And well, I know a lot of example of composer, because it's what I study when I was young, but there is also many example of painters, and that's amazing. It's just like you imagine your death, and then that happened. And you choose, even, because I think that in the book, identification is clearly made with the character and the writer. That's amazing. And it's just like she kind of tell us that imagination is everything somehow. I don't know. Like, and for the religious part, I think that this kind of, you know, blinking, I don't know how to say that in English, like when you blink an eye, like you say, haha. It's the whole trick of the story, like she's trying to induce things, and her point of view, her view of seeing how life could be, could have been, and yeah.
I know we've touched on prophecy and things like that, and a lot of us may have witnessed, or it might have been presented on the forum, where she essentially wrote out, I'm going to be successful, I'm going to write books that are going to be witnessed by hundreds or thousands, and I'll be able to buy a home and things like that, or I will be a published author. So in a way, maybe she tapped into some energy, or whatever you want to call it, that had its pluses and minuses, and but her stories are very relevant, almost to the point that it's a little bit eerie or scary, as if she did tap into some alternate universe that was all too similar to our own. I like the idea of the alternate worlds rejecting humans, just as our bodies reject outside pathogens and bacteria or something like that. Butler is very, there's a lot more than just some middle-aged woman writing science fiction novels or literature. And I think I'll spare, go ahead.
Well, but maybe just the force of her own personality and determination, not, again, like Lauren, she had a will to shape the future as well.
I just got this book today, and it's kind of interesting because it, I don't know if you can see. Is that the right way or not the right way? So you can't see it. Yeah. So I've got a chapter, and it's kind of interesting because it's in terms of trying to pick up clues about how the third book might have gone, or sort of fragments of this one. It says that in an earlier outline of the manuscript entitled God of Clay, as well as in the published sequel Parable of the Talents, Butler makes Olamina a much more problematic character in relation to her daughter Larkin, who ceases to believe in the Earthseed destiny and focuses on the misery she sees among the free poor of the world, who are victims of global warming and economic upheaval and will not be helped by extrasolar colonies. So it's kind of interesting that she didn't include that explicitly in the books, and maybe that was something that would have come out later, although I guess it's sort of hinted at, especially in the discussion that we're having.
Like she backed off from it a bit. That's interesting.
Maybe she was saving it for a later book too. I think there's definitely room for Asha Vera, her character, to develop and unfold. It'd be interesting, like, where she really, because what, she must be in their 30s or so, 30s, 40s, like when, I mean, maybe she's older by the end of the book. I don't know, but that would be interesting if she has her own destiny and her own purpose and what that might be and how it would be different. I'm curious how you all, like the group, people in the group, like how plausible, now that we've read both of these books, how plausible is the Earthseed religion to you? Like, could you imagine yourself as an Earthseed member? Is that something that would motivate you, give meaning to your life? Is something you could identify with, something you would, because somebody at least is taking it semi-seriously, like this guy that did the website, and I don't know how much, like how seriously you can take a story that you know is fictional, and yet this is not merely fictional. Like Butler is, divining something about our contemporary or just emergent near future reality. And is this a plausible answer, like, to the existential condition that we find ourselves in, like to our existential, ethical, climate, ecological, like this whole scenario of issues that we're facing? Is Earthseed an answer to that?
Well, I was skeptical for most of the reading of both books. But by the time I got to the end, I actually started to feel that maybe there was more to this than I thought all along. But I'm not quite sure how to articulate why I thought that. I think it has to do with this thing, what I was saying earlier about uncertainty. Maybe there's a bit of a reflection that she does at the very end about about a kind of a religion which is more open to being challenged, more open to being to dealing with uncertainty, more open to being open-ended in a sense. And I felt that by the end, I felt that this was maybe the strength of the idea rather than this particular tenets that were in the verses. And that from that perspective, the religion as laid out had something to say to us in our contemporary world about where religion could go, whether or not that meant that this would be the religion. But this idea of being open-ended and allowing other ideas and other approaches to come into the religion. Most religions today are pretty closed down. They're set on their bases. They're anchored there, and they're not very easily addressable. I found that idea compelling by the end of the books.
I think part of the reason the religion might become more compelling as you go along, I suspect it's probably true of most systems of faith that the lived faith counts for more than the text. And so I do think that the text of Earthseed is a little slight and insubstantial. Maybe not fully, maybe it's just that the glimpses we get of it aren't fully worked out. But the story that Octavia Butler tells of people living this faith is what is compelling. It's in the Christian tradition, Saint Francis said something like, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And I think that there's a sense that Lauren is preaching Earthseed at all times, but she does it with her life and her actions. So we can look at Acorn and say, that is a way that I would like to live, and the faith system that inspires it must be a good one. I think that's truly how people become adherents of faith systems. They don't just read something and agree with it. I think it's much more subjective and emotive than that.
And one has to think about the definition of religion in a lot of ways too. When we hear the word religion, we're going to tap into one of the five or six main fields of Christianity, Buddhism, Jainism, Hinduism, whatever it might be. But I really liked what Miranda posted, I think yesterday or a couple days ago, about, it's from Electra Street, it's called To Get Ready for Climate Change, Read Octavia Butler. So it's the author calls it realist science fiction. And it says that predicts the convergent 21st century crises of capitalism, climate, and humanism. And in a way, maybe if we're focused on the fundamental Christian society, the climate change is going to be mostly denied, or it'll be seen as an act of God destroying this or that on Earth. And so as more and more people realize, well, maybe climate change is caused by humans, maybe we can do something to change this, even if on a personal scale of recycling or something like that, taking a religious stance of personal change isn't necessarily going to work. So we need something different. Forming a religion, so the viability of Earthseed as a religion, I would imagine that the educational part would come out strongly in, say, our society as more troubles come our way, where there might be a turn towards past religions like Christian America and say, let's hold on to our beliefs. But there would be a lot of people, as I think Butler did great near the end of the book, kind of showing, well, this person, Lauren, really lives her faith, really sees that change is everywhere, that destruction is all around us, or chaos. And as a shaper of chaos, even on a personal level, she's not magically doing anything other than taking her strong personality and becoming something that can be a real way out. If you want to believe in this side of the religion, as we discussed in the last our last discussion, if you want to believe in the destiny, that's fine. But this particular religion allows for you to tap out of the religion and focus on, well, let's better ourselves, let's better our environment, let's educate ourselves to see what's really going on. So, yeah, and back to the article, it talks about capitalism, that, and even, which I found interesting, was introducing a new idea of humanism. Like, our idea of humanism is human-centric, and this author goes to say that it's a new basis for humanism, hyper-empathy, or having compassion for one another. That goes back to Christianity in a way. But at the same time, it's a search for having deep empathy, not just for each other, but also everything all around us. So I don't know where I'm going with this at this point, but yeah. So I'll stop there.
Well, the hyper-empathy is kind of like a mutation, you know? It's almost like this, one way of looking at it is like an evolutionary mutation. And one of the ways that Olamina describes religions, I would like to read from the books, from Earthseed, the books of the living. She says, all religions are ultimately cargo cults. Adherents perform required rituals, follow specific rules, and expect to be supernaturally gifted with desired rewards. There's those talents again. Long life, honor, wisdom, children, good health, wealth, victory over opponents, immortality after death, any desired rewards. Earthseed offers its own rewards, room for small groups of people to begin new lives and new ways of life with new opportunities, new wealth, new concepts of wealth, new challenges to grow and to learn and to decide what to become. Earthseed is the dawning adulthood of the human species. It offers the only true immortality. It enables the seeds of the earth to become the seeds of new life, new communities on new earths. The destiny of Earthseed is to take root among the stars and there again to grow, to learn, and to fly. So I think that goes back to, Mary, your point earlier as well about, you know, what makes a religion or a movement like this attractive. Like, it's not just the belief system, but the, like as she puts it, the you know, the opportunities, it's the rewards, the wealth, new concepts of wealth, new challenges to grow and learn. And Miranda, that article that you shared, one of the points it made had to do with skilling up, and like this way that one of the things that's cool about the Earthseed communities, like they can garden, you know, they can hunt, they could, you know, they can take care of themselves in a way that, you know, your standard middle class suburban kind of, you know, person can't really do. Has lost that those skills, those abilities, like that being in touch with nature and being in touch with your own, your native abilities, your own indigenous wisdom. I think that's something that Earthseed would offer. I think there's a connection there, it seems, too, with like Malcolm X, Nation of Islam, like the ways that they focused on building strong communities, on education, on developing skills, on becoming like, you know, becoming mature members of the community that take responsibility for things. I mean, from the individual personal level to family, to the, you know, to the wider community, like that ethos, I think is wherever it shows up. I mean, whether it's in Nation of Islam or in Earthseed or in Christianity for that matter, because there are Christian communities that practice this as well. I think that's a general value, you know, like it doesn't hurt to be able to grow your own food. You know, it doesn't hurt to be able to, you know, organize and to, and actually to have communal ways of dealing with the existential issues of life, birth and death and separation and change. And purpose, you know, like, why am I here? What's, you know, why, what's the reason for this suffering? Or if there isn't a reason, how can I give it a reason? I found myself feeling, yeah, I could do Earthseed. You know, I don't know if I like the ritual kind of things, like the little mantras that they do, like, you know, a god has changed the way they repeat that in this culty kind of way. Like, I don't think I would enjoy doing that. I'd probably rebel against that part of it. But I mean, the basic tenets, I think it's incomplete as a theology. I think, as we discussed in one of our earlier conversations, I don't think it has as much of the transcendent that it could, or the, like, nobody meditates, I guess, in Earthseed. Like, I'd like to meditate in my religion if I had one. Just that sort of silence and that like, I think it would be useful anyway as one of the skill sets. But yeah, I mean, I found, like Jeffrey too, I found myself feeling this is plausible. I could see myself doing it if it were real. And if I went, you know, through, or I came across it in the kind of circumstances that Butler describes, this, you know, this general chaos and this, you know, this imperative, this need, you know, the need to band together, people band together and help each other grow and help each other, you know, live better for a reason that they share in common. I think that's, yeah, I think that works for me. You know, I feel that need also. So thanks for indulging my question there.
But from my, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I think I didn't read it as being a religion when I was reading it. I think it made me think a lot of Murray Bookchin stuff. And yeah, I think it's interesting for me, I guess, from my perspective, I was thinking in order to get these ideas out there, she's putting it forwards in this form that could be considered religion. But from, I didn't really see it as that. But yeah, that was... But yeah, so I could totally, you know, get on board with many aspects of it, but I wouldn't necessarily, yeah.
That was kind of my comment I was briefly going to make, is that I was going to ask if this could be more of a political move in a lot of ways, not necessarily so she could run for office, but to branch out, and if Earthseed was a political party, I would vote for Earthseed, for example. That's about all I wanted to say there.
I think that's interesting too, though, are different contexts, like being in the US, being in Canada, being in the UK, and the different way that religiosity is kind of a social experience. There's another book I'm reading, and the author's name is escaping me right now, but it's basically it's by a British author, and it's an argument for the emotional logic of Christianity. It was suggested on the forum in the Readers Underground reading suggestions thread. So I should go back and look at exactly the title of that. But this art, the sentiment around religion in the UK is a lot lower than it is in the US. And so one of the things that the author is arguing is that, you know, any kind of belief or expression of faith is this is what his point of view, like I'm just translating it, is looked at as, you know, not to be taken seriously as foppish or something, you know, by in general in public. Whereas in the US, it's quite a bit different. And like religiosity and politics are not as well separated, like well distinguished, I think, as they may be in the more secular cultures that you're... So seeing the political side of it, I think, is really fruitful because, I mean, this is a political, it's a deeply, deeply political movement. And on that basis too, like, I think, you know, it maybe brings into, like, what kind of, like, what does politics have to tap into in the human psyche in order to become effective, you know? Because I mean, one of the, I think, crises that we have is a crisis of faith in our politics. Like, what does our politics offer us? Does it offer us something, like, does it really envision a better world, or is it this kind of fragmented, you know, nest of special interests, or is it, you know, like more fragmented identity groups, or you know, other, let's say, less ennobling, less inspiring kind of messages? Like, does the political message of Earthseed resonate, even if its religiosity doesn't? And does religiosity have something to do with the political message resonating? You know, like, where is that line exactly?
Lauren certainly seems to consider the religiosity important. There, is it Bankel maybe who says, well, why don't you just say change is really important? Why does it have to be God is change? And she really doubles down on it. She really wants it to be not just a political system, but a faith. So I don't have an answer. I just think that's interesting.
Also, the whole discussion of the Crusaders camp and, to a lesser extent, the wider community of Christian America is a kind of a counter-argument. So what not to do, right? Obviously, the Crusaders is an extreme thing, and you could just deal with it as extreme and then just reject it all, you know, as extreme. But I think a careful reading of the Crusader camp actually suggests there are elements of the Crusader camp that are part of existing religious practices, even though it's an extreme form there. And so I think you could, in a way, what not to do in a more than just in, you know, don't do the extreme things, but some of the other elements that are, you know, like, maybe I'm not, I need to think it out a bit more, but it seemed to me that, and certainly the Christian America and the wider form that they have is also a kind of a, what not to do kind of thing.
Definitely not going to join Christian America. that sounds like a scary group of people. I wanted to add a quick footnote to my previous comment. The title I was looking for was Unapologetic: Why Despite Everything Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense, by Francis Spufford. Jeffrey, I mean, there are obviously aspects of, you know, Christian America that are attractive and that are helpful to, you know, people. So it's not that it's, you know, and Marcus is not a bad person. Like he's done some very bad things, but he's also come out of this terrible experience and, he's trying to find a way to fulfill his own purpose, to give his own gifts. You know, he has, by all accounts, he's very attractive. That's the other thing that is repeated over and over, how attractive he is. Like, everybody is like, thinks he's so hot, right? His niece, you know, his sister, his congregants, you know, they're all very enamored of him, and he doesn't seem to, you know, he's not like a child abuser or something like the way that it seems many Christian American men are, or otherwise, you know, abusive in that sense. So there must be something to it too. Clearly, like, don't, you know, enslave people, don't, you know, molest, so forth. And so it makes emotional sense, doesn't it? Like, even Christian America makes emotional sense in a world that is in crisis, right? Like, it's an answer to that crisis. It's an answer to the existential crisis. Like, how to live? Like, how do I survive this? How do I somehow provide for, you know, for those I love? And I mean, for me, like, one of the things about Lauren, and I think is unfair actually about her daughter's critique is that I don't think Lauren was just doing it for personal glory or something. Like, I think that she, you know, gets a certain respect. She gets, like, it's healthy for her to have community and to be a leader. I think she expressing her leadership is important, but I don't get the feeling from her that it's narcissistic. And with Marcus, it is kind of, and there's parts of his personality that he can't express. Like, it's strongly suggested. He seems to communicate to Larkin that he's gay. And, but that's obviously not something he can express. Even the other, you know, his community, the congregants say that they whisper about him, and it seems to be okay. Maybe if he wasn't so charismatic, he would have been, you know, re-educated. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's such a, talking about religion, God, and everything is very difficult, because I think we can talk about it intellectually and we can talk about it politically, but when you get down to it, it really touches on, like, core things. And so, you know, we do have strong beliefs. Even our non-beliefs are, in a way, strong. And I think that Butler is, through these different characters, exploring that and exploring the pros and cons, the great benefits of, you know, having certain qualities like Lauren does, or like Marcus does, or even Jarrett, you know, like played a certain role. Like he, you know, in the big, vast narrative of history, perhaps he held together, you know, the country at a time, even though it meant all this brutality, it held something together that later becomes, you know, a component in a better society or something like that. Like, you know, that's the thing about history. It's just not, it's not black or white. And so I learned from this, you know, as we're into this last bit of our talk, like, I think I'm learning just what it means for, you know, for communities to organize to, you know, to achieve things, or to around, like, ways of living. Like, we actually have real questions to face. I think that's part of, Miranda, your research. And I think a book like this, it hitting so close to home as it does, like, gives us tools to actually think through our dilemmas and our challenges.
I'm certainly motivated to go and read more of Butler after this exercise. She gets under your skin.
Maybe we should talk about, are we still thinking of having one more meeting where we read one of her short stories? Is that sort of on the agenda? It wasn't super clear to me.
Yeah, well, Douglas proposed that we do the story that was like a video, or there's a, like, a video of it, or I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but
it's an audio recording of a short story she did called The Book of Martha. And just take note that it's my own personal spin on, might even be an agenda I have on this VR dream mask / tap into your dreams to discover ways to tap into reality or something like that. But it's essentially just a short story and kind of a utopian vision working out, but it parallels a lot of what was going on here. And it was just a suggestion. We don't even have to bring it up. We touched on it today quite a bit, so at least what I perceived the conversation revolving around. It's about a 40-minute listen. I posted you can also find the story in Bloodchild, which the 2005 version. But no, I'd rather open it up right now like you're doing, Mary, and see where we want to go with this. So that could be a tidbit of something. And I could potentially lead out a short bit of the conversation, but it might be a good opening toward more of the talk of relating it to our own society, where we can go with society, as well as utopian versus dystopian. But there's quite a few themes that tie into both stories here. So it's just a thought.
Well, we also talked at one point about bringing in the relationship between Butler's writing and feminist writings. I can't remember who brought that idea forward, but it seemed that might be also interesting, although it would require outside reading from the group, and I don't have any direct text that I can point to at this point, except to notice that Donna Haraway in this book on that it's not one that we have. But this latest book that she wrote, I can't remember the title of it right now, but that it has, yes, that's the one, Staying with the Trouble. It has a chapter in it that bears essentially on a discussion of Le Guin and Butler. So it's certainly a feminist understanding of the two. So perhaps we could have a look at that as well. And bring in because the discussion, Le Guin is another writer who's been discussed in this group before. And so it might be interesting to sort of, and they are both two very strong female voices within science fiction. So I think it would be interesting maybe to bring in other issues like that, not just focus on Butler's own writing and her own story. In an extra session, as it were.
I'm down for that. I'd love to continue the conversation. And either we could read Butler's piece or Haraway, or maybe we should probably determine that for the next one. But I like this way of thinking. You know, I like the SF. Like what falls under that rubric, because Haraway has SF as a few different things: speculative fiction, science fiction, speculative feminism, string figures, and she also has a kind of bacteriological, lateral sort of thinking. She talks about critters and like the ways that little, small things happen. I think it brings in more of the minor gesture as well. So I don't know. We may or may not define.
Well, my suggestion, because one would have to buy Haraway's book in order to read the chapter, and I don't really want everybody to have to do that.
I can scan it if you want.
Oh, okay. And
I don't know how you. I think you can scan one chapter from a book without. That isn't that. I don't know what copyright laws are in different places, but
fair use. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That would be great.
You have to have less than 10% of the whole book to be acceptable.
Yeah, and Haraway's book has got more than 10 chapters in it, so we should be okay. So if you could do that, Miranda, relatively quickly and get it up on the site so that people have a chance to look at it.
Yeah, that's fine. I've got a photocopier just there, so it shouldn't take too long.
Okay.
I'll do it tomorrow.
And then we'll have the two texts, the Haraway text and the Butler text to look at. We'll do it next week, because the week after is the week that I'm going to be away. Anyway, so we'll do it next week. It's not a lot of reading, so compared to the reading we've been doing. So, and then we'll discuss what book we're going to read next. Although there are other people who have had some things to say about that too, so who aren't here. So, Mark, your silence.
Oh, there's a thread on the forum called Reading Suggestions. It should be near the top under the Readers Underground channel, but if you search for it, you'll find it. Yeah. Some other suggestions have been made there. But this could, this could happen. This could be like a seed, you know. There could be seeds, multiple seeds.
And I like to have I think I'm addicted to these reading groups since Doug, Donna, Marco, and I, and I think Johnny on a couple of times, read Soul Mountain together. And I'm rather addicted to these discussion groups around fiction. And we do lots of ones about philosophy and other writers on this site. But I think having at least one channel open on fiction is a good thing. So I'm willing to, keep running something if we can find a book that we all are excited about. And I tend to feel that you get a series of books on paper that all look interesting and it's hard to decide, but you have to find one that you're really passionate about in order to, otherwise, because it is a certain amount of organization to set it up. So, yeah. I'd be happy if somebody else wanted to take over and do it. Doug did it the last time for Soul Mountain. I did the organization, so somebody else could take on the organize. But I'd be happy to keep going with it too. So.
I don't want to take up the discussion time, but it would be great to chat to you sometime to find out sort of how you decided upon reading Butler's work and how long you've been going and like what being part of this group means to you. But I don't know if that's something that I could organize with you separately through the contact information that you've given me or...
Well, we could discuss it here right now. I think we've still got a little bit of time before the end of the hour. Also, it'd be nice to hear if there's any follow-up on your end, Miranda, about the work that you're doing. It would be nice to sort of stay in touch about what you end up doing with this. But in terms of the Butler, we as Marco mentioned, the reading suggestions list that we have up now is more recent than the one we originally were looking at. But we had a series of a small list of suggestions originally. Soul Mountain was on the list and The Parable of the Sower was on the list. And there were some other book titles. I can't remember what they were now. Doug, do you remember?
Yeah, there's quite a few. The Three World Problem was one that kind of ties in with the right. Soul Mountain in a way with the Chinese Cultural Revolution and science fiction, so it's potential as well. But you wanted to say something, Miranda?
Yeah, just that in terms of the project, on the page where you've signed the consent form, there's the information sheet, but I will be in touch, keep in touch with you with all the sort of developments and work in progress so that you can have a look, comment if you want to. So I will, and that's part of the reason why I asked for your contact information as well. So I'll be in touch definitely in that sense. Okay. But also in terms of if anyone wants to would be up for a sort of follow-up interview, I'll get in touch with you as well.
I was also going to mention that we had originally planned next week's session that Jeffrey is talking about for the follow-up for Octavia Butler with Haraway and her short story potentially. But I think it's 3 weeks from now. We have that space open. So three Wednesdays from now, we have another space open at the same time, same date. I know I personally would love to be there because we barely touched upon some of your perspectives. We haven't fully discussed everything. So if you'd like to potentially lead that, we can talk about it more, of course. That makes sense.
Yeah, sure, if people are up for it. otherwise I can contact you another way, or, you know, whatever you're up for.
Oh, that sounds like a good idea. I'd forgotten that you had some ideas about discussion items, Miranda. So that would be good if you could lead one group like that. So we'll do next week, we'll do the one that we've set out to do, but then 2 weeks later, we'll leave that one open and we'll set you up for being the animator. Is that good?
Yeah, no pressure.
No pressure, yeah.
I'll see. You know, you have to tell me, give me all your tips and...
to come back to the question about why butter, well, I mean, to some extent, I mean, it's also a group thing, and I tend to want to be attentive to what the group wants, but at the same time, since I was there was some, for instance, there was some discussion, a couple of people felt that they were oversaturated with reading and they didn't want to read another book so quickly. But I felt that, as I say, without a fiction reading group, I like to have the attentiveness to the fiction rather than just to the philosophy and the other stuff. So I felt, for me, it was important. It was in the summer. I wanted to have an ongoing reading group dealing with fiction. So even though there were some reservations, I went ahead and organized it around Butler. It was on our list, but Butler is as I said, this group has already looked at Le Guin, and I have an affinity for Le Guin. But Butler is one of the other writers that I had read one of her books years ago, and I wanted to read more of. So it became a priority for me to read Butler. And Mary and I belong to another reading group, a local reading group in town here in Quebec City. And it's organized by a fellow who's active in the Anglican Church here. And he is Anglican, right, Mary?
He's like a professor of theology, Protestant theology or something like that.
So it's a group looking at religion and science fiction. And so we read together Canticle for Leibowitz, which I had read years ago, but I must admit it was enthralling to read it with the group, because I learned such a ton of stuff that I, you know, especially from somebody who has a theological background, because it's so full of references to Catholic, mostly Catholic theology. And so having several experts around the room who were grounded in that was extraordinary. And Butler was on their list, but they decided to go for the next one to do Android's Dream of Electric Sheep. So the Philip Dick story that's behind Blade Runner, which is also a really interesting context to read. But given they went that way, I thought, well, okay, we'll go towards Butler and fill out the female feminist science fiction end of things from the Le Guin background. So that was sort of my own reason for going that way. But, and anybody who wanted to come along for the ride, and there were...
Yeah, there's just so much going on right now with Black writers in science fiction. And so that was what made me want to read it.
Because in terms of Black writers, there's Delaney, who is, I'm hard put to decide whether or not my favorite science fiction writer is Samuel Delaney or Ursula Le Guin. Maybe Butler now. But Delaney is an extraordinary writer. And so maybe we could pick up one of Delaney's books too. Anyway.
An idea. I would love to read Delaney. Delaney's he's a writer's writer, I think.
Yes.
And I, in general, I want to keep reading SF. I enjoy having this in the mix, and as sort of as a way of life, at least, you know, my life now, I definitely like to keep reading fiction. I think that, you know, as far as how these come about, it's pretty anarchic right now. There's not like a specific way to do it, but somehow it's a mix of initiative, consensus, signaling, like interest, and then something crystallizes, and that seems like how this came about. So I imagine that'll keep happening, and it doesn't just have to happen on Wednesdays at this time. It could be, you know, like as occurred, organizing something that you feel passionate about that others resonate with. It could be at a different time, and we have use of the video, we have use of the forum, and we could self-organize as we wish to, I think, to explore our respective interests. I'd love to read Haraway, Delaney. As long as we pace it, this to me, every 2 weeks is a good pacing for me, just speaking personally about like what works for me. Philip K. Dick would be great to read too. Valis, I have not read Valis. I read Ubik. I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in the last couple of years. But Valis sounds like one of the must reads.
Well, one of the Delaney books, it's not one book, it's four books, is the Never Yona series, which is actually classified as fantasy, not science fiction. But it's odd fantasy. I mean, it is fantasy, but it's fantasy with layers and layers of other ideas folded into it. And there are four of them. So that would be possibly an interesting thing to wade through all four Never Yona books.
Okay. Let me get through The Life Divine first. I want to mention one thing. Donna, who's not here, has offered to lead a talk on the poetry of Badr Shakir al-Sayyab. He was an Iraqi poet. There's a particular poem that's translated as The Rain Song, which is kind of a work of Iraqi modernism, and she described it as not equivalent to exactly, but you know, one analog or something would be like The Wasteland, or you know, these kinds of, you know, large poems that we'd be familiar with in the Anglo context. But that would be on November 16th, and we have some translations and some other related texts that you know, we could read. So that's a Friday, by the way, I think. Anyway, I haven't gotten a post up about it, but I'm going to do so soon. And I guess for me, just it also, that relates because I want to read SF. I also want to read writers from other countries, other cultures. I think that's a really important, you know, thing to have in the mix. So I liked when we, Gao Jingjiang, and just this weekend here in Boulder, I attended a literature festival called the Jaipur Literature Festival. Here's a program. And learned of some really amazing writers and authors from Nigeria, from Kenya, from India. There's not, who else is here? Anyway, I'd have to come back and you know, go over the specifics, but there's just so much out there that is really worth reading. And so whatever we could do to create a space, an environment where people can explore different kinds of texts and pursue interests and find little like interest groups. And like, I want to support that. I'd like that. That'd be my vision, you know, for as far as like a, you know, community thing or a social movement, would be a real revitalization of communities of reading. So, and writing too, for that matter. Thanks. I'm just, if you're watching this, you can start, you know, you can start something if you're interested, like just put it out there. That's what the forum is for. And so,
And the forum's gotten too big for any one of us to follow all the conversations. So that's part of the thing about the forum getting larger and more people doing things. So I've given up on being present for every discussion. It just can't be done. So So having several groups running parallel on different books is par for the course as far as I'm concerned. I just won't be on every discussion, but having them all up there would be extraordinary.
I think it creates an atmosphere, it creates an environment, an ecosystem, like just in the air. Even if you're not personally reading something, it has a way of seeping into other conversations. And so like Doug will mention something that, like, I haven't read Simon Don, but something that, you know, Doug is studying with a couple of other people, you know, I get some residual benefit from that. Like it becomes part of my cognitive environment. And I think that's healthy. That's what, anyway, it's another matter, but.
I think you have to watch out if you're getting your information sourced from me.
Yeah.
I did make the page for next week. So that's October 3rd, right? Next week?
Yes.
Okay. So I've listed that as our wrap up plus the short story from Butler and the essay from Haraway, which is, I believe it's called Sowing Worlds, a Seed Bag for Terraforming with Earth Others.
So yep.
That title alone sounds fun. But yeah, I really like Haraway. And then week 11, which is October 17th, will be the potential follow-up with Miranda or further discussion on how to proceed. So we kind of jumped into this wondering if anybody had any final comments for talents or something like that.
No, I think we're good.
So if I scan the chapter tomorrow, can I just upload it to the thread, or is there somewhere else I should put it?
I made it a wiki page or a wiki post, so you can click the edit button at the bottom and add whatever you'd like. If you have trouble, you can send it through email or something like that, or just put it in a separate post and we'll take care of it.
Yeah, it's a PDF though, it'll you can drag it right in. You can just drag it into the window and it'll upload.
Okay, great. I'll do that.
Great.
Thank you for that.
So see you all next week.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.